Soon after Frank joined the party, he made a point of driving up to Berkeley, where he spent the night with his brother, and told him the news. "I was quite upset about it," Robert testified in 1954, without explaining just why he was unhappy over Frank's taking this step. Party membership, to be sure, was not without its risks. But in 1937, there was little stigma attached to it among Berkeley liberals. "It wasn't regarded," Robert testified, "perhaps foolishly, as a great state crime to be a member of the Communist Party or as a matter of dishonor or shame." Still, it was clear that the University of California administration was hostile to anyone affiliated with the CP, and Frank was in the process of trying to build an academic career. And, unlike Robert, Frank didn't have tenure. If Robert was upset with Frank's decision, perhaps he thought his younger brother was being unwisely headstrong in making such a commitment, or was too much under the influence of his radical wife. Despite Robert's own political awakening, he felt no compulsion to join the Communist Party as a matter of principle. Frank, on the other hand, evidently felt an emotional need to make a formal commitment. The brothers may have shared common political instincts, but Frank was proving himself to be far more impetuous. He still very much idolized Robert, but with his marriage and his politics, he was trying to stake out his own persona and step out of Robert's shadow. In 1943, a colleague of Frank's during his 2 years at Stanford University told an FBI agent that, in his opinion, Frank Oppenheimer had followed the lead and dictates of his brother, J. Robert Oppenheimer, on all of his political attitudes and affiliations. This anonymous source had it mostly wrong. Frank had joined the party independently, against his brother's advice. The informant had one thing right, however. He assured the FBI that he believed both Oppenheimers were basically loyal to this country. In the eyes of their friends, and of the FBI, the Oppenheimer brothers were extraordinarily close. What Frank did would always reflect on Robert, and, try as he might to arrange things for his brother, Robert would never quite be able to protect Frank from the glare of his own fame. Compared with his guileless brother, Robert was an enigma. All of their friends knew where his political sympathies lay, but the exact nature of his relationship to the Communist Party remains to this day hazy and vague. He later described his friend Hokin Chevalier as a parlor pink. He had very wide connections with all kinds of front organizations. He was interested in left-wing writers. He talked quite freely of his opinions. The description might easily have applied to Oppenheimer himself. Without question, Robert was surrounded by relatives, friends, and colleagues who at some point or other were members of the Communist Party. As a left-wing New Dealer, he gave considerable sums of money to causes championed by the party. But he always insisted that he was never a card-carrying member of the CP. Instead, he said his associations with the party were very brief and very intense. He was referring to the Spanish Civil War period, but afterwards he continued to participate in meetings in which dues-paying Communist Party members discussed current events. These meetings, encouraged by the party, were specifically designed to involve independent intellectuals like Oppenheimer and blur the boundaries of Communist Party identity. But never having been a formal card-carrying member left Oppenheimer the option of deciding for himself how he wished to define his relationship to the party. For a brief time, he may well have thought of himself as an unaffiliated comrade. There is no doubt that in later years, he minimized the extent of his associations with the party. Quite bluntly, any attempt to label Robert Oppenheimer a party member is a futile exercise, as the FBI learned to its frustration over many years. In fact, his associations with communists were a natural and socially seamless outgrowth of his sympathies and his station in life. As a professor at the University of California in the late 1930s, Oppenheimer lived in a politically charged environment. Moving in such circles, he inevitably left the impression with many of his friends who were formal party members that he was one of them. Robert, after all, wanted to be liked, and he certainly believed in the social justice goals the party espoused and worked for. His friends could think what they wanted. Not surprisingly, some in the party did think he was a comrade. And naturally, when the FBI used wiretaps to monitor the conversations of these people talking about Oppenheimer, they occasionally heard bona fide party members discuss him as one of their own. And yet again, other FBI wiretaps record party members complaining about Oppenheimer's aloofness and unreliability. Most importantly, there is no evidence that he ever submitted himself to party discipline. Given his strong personal alignment with much, if not most, of the party program, where he did disagree, he never trimmed his views to conform to the party line. Tellingly, he expressed qualms about the totalitarian nature of the Soviet regime. He openly admired Franklin Roosevelt and defended the New Deal. And while he was a member of various popular front organizations dominated by the Communist Party, he was also a staunch civil libertarian and a prominent member of the American Civil Liberties Union. In short, he was a classic fellow-traveling New Deal progressive who admired the Communist Party's opposition to fascism in Europe and its championing of labor rights at home. It is neither surprising nor revealing that he worked with party members in support of those goals. All this ambiguity is compounded by the fact that during these years of the Popular Front, the Communist Party's very organizational structure, particularly in California, led to a blurring of the distinction between casual affiliation and actual membership. As Jessica Mitford wrote in her irreverent memoir of her experiences in the San Francisco branch of the party, "In those days, the party was a strange mixture of openness and secrecy." The conspiratorial-sounding cell of 3 to 5 members had been replaced by branches or clubs, a nomenclature deemed more consistent with American political tradition. Hundreds of people might belong to these clubs in which party business was conducted in a fairly open and informal manner. Everyone was welcome, and people, often including FBI informers, attended weekly meetings in rented halls without too much attention paid as to whether their party dues were up to date. On the other hand, Mitford reports that she and her husband were at first assigned to the Southside Club, one of the few closed or secret branches reserved for government workers, doctors, lawyers, and others whose occupations could have been jeopardized by open affiliation with the party. Many left-of-center, pro-union, anti-fascist intellectuals in the late 1930s never affiliated with the Communist Party. And yet, many who did join the party chose to hide their affiliation even if, like Oppenheimer, they were politically active on behalf of causes supported by the party. So numerous were the party's secret members that Communist Party Chief Earl Browder griped in June 1936 about too many prominent figures in American society hiding their party identity. "How shall we dissipate the Red Scare from among the Reds?" he asked. "Some of these comrades hide as a shameful secret their communist opinions and affiliations. They hysterically beg the party to keep as far away from their work as possible." Years later, Hocken Chevalier insisted that Oppenheimer was one such secret party member. But when closely questioned about the unit Robert allegedly belonged to, Chevalier described an innocuous gathering of friends more akin to the discussion group he reported in his 1965 memoir than the sort of official closed unit described by Mitford.
He initiated it," Chevalier, referring to Oppenheimer, told Martin Sherwin. "It was a closed unit and unofficial. There's no record of it. It was not known to anyone except one person. I don't know who he was, but he was in the top echelon of the party in San Francisco." This unofficial group, known only to one person initially, contained just 6 or 7 members, though at one point as many as 12 were participating in its discussions. "We discussed things that were going on locally and in the state and in the country and in the world," recalled Chevalier. It is Chevalier's version of this story that is reflected in the FBI files. The FBI first opened a file on Oppenheimer in March 1941. His name had come to the Bureau's attention quite by accident the previous December. For almost a year, the FBI had been wiretapping the conversations of William Schneiderman, the California Communist Party's state secretary, and Isaac Pops Folkoff, the state treasurer. The wiretaps were not authorized by any court or by the attorney general and were therefore illegal. But in December 1940, when one of the Bureau's agents in San Francisco overheard Folkoff referring to a 3 p.m. appointment at Chevalier's house as a meeting of the big boys, an agent was sent to jot down license plate numbers. One of the cars found to be parked outside Chevalier's home was Oppenheimer's Chrysler Roadster. By the spring of 1941, the FBI was identifying Oppenheimer as a professor reported from other sources as having communist sympathies. The FBI noted that he served on the executive committee of the American Civil Liberties Union, which the Bureau labeled a Communist Party front group. Inevitably, an investigative file was opened on Oppenheimer, which would eventually grow to some 7,000 pages. That same month, Oppenheimer's name was put on a list of persons to be considered for custodial detention pending investigation in the event of a national emergency. Another FBI document, citing the investigative documents of T2, another government agency, claimed that Oppenheimer was a member of a professional section of the Communist Party. One of these T2 documents found in Oppenheimer's FBI file included a 2-page excerpt from a longer, unidentified report listing the membership of various branches of the Communist Party. Names and addresses are provided for the Longshoreman's Branch, the Seaman's Branch, and the Professional Section. 9 members are listed for this Professional Section: Helen Pell, Dr. Thomas Addis, J. Robert Oppenheimer, Hoken Chevalier, Alexander Kahn, Aubrey Grossman, Herbert Reisner, George R. Anderson, and I. Richard Gladstein. Oppenheimer clearly knew some of these individuals, Pell, Addis, Chevalier, and Kahn, and it is equally clear that at least some of them were in fact Communist Party members. But it is impossible to evaluate the credibility of this undated document. According to Chevalier, who spoke with Martin Sherwin at length and in detail, each member of this alleged closed unit paid dues to the Communist Party except for Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer paid his separately, Chevalier speculated, because he probably paid a lot more than he was supposed to. Or, as Robert always insisted, he made contributions to causes, but never paid dues at all. But the rest of us paid to one member who was also a known member, an open member of the party, Chevalier continued. I'm not supposed to say, but it was Philip Morrison. Otherwise, according to Chevalier, the group took no orders from the party and functioned simply as a group of academics who met to share ideas about international affairs and politics. Morrison, of course, has long acknowledged that he joined the Young Communist League in 1938 and the CP itself in 1939 or 1940. When asked about Chevalier's recollection, Morrison flatly denied that he had been in the same party unit as Oppenheimer. As a student, he pointed out, he would never have been assigned to a unit with faculty members. When asked by Sherwin in 1982, "What made you a member of the Communist Party as opposed to just a group of people who were left?" Chevalier replied, "I don't know. We paid dues." When Sherwin pressed him again, "Did you receive any orders from the party?" Chevalier said, "No. In a sense, we weren't regular party members." At the time, he explained, it was possible for men like himself and Oppenheimer to think of themselves as politically committed intellectuals who were nevertheless free from party discipline. Members of this group contributed money to the party's causes. They gave speeches at party-sponsored events, and they drafted articles and pamphlets for party publications. And yet, explained Chevalier, we both were and were not, any way you want to look at it. Pressed further to explain this ambiguity, Chevalier said, it had a kind of shadowy existence. It existed, but it wasn't identified, and that had some influence because we had our views about certain things that were happening, which were transmitted to the center, and we were consulted about certain things. Apparently, the same thing happened in many other parts of the United States, closed units for professionals or people who didn't want to be identified in any way. The ambiguous nature of Oppenheimer's relationship to the CP, as described by Chevalier, is corroborated by Steve Nelson, a charismatic Communist Party leader in San Francisco and a friend of Oppenheimer's in the years 1940 to 43. Nelson saw Oppenheimer socially, but it was also his job to serve as one of the party's liaisons to the university community. I met socially with this group, Nelson explained in a 1981 interview, that included some party members and some non-party people where they discussed freely what's ahead of us. This group was discussing questions of foreign policy. The general mood, which included Oppenheimer's mood, was that it would be tragic if the United States, England, and France do not form some kind of alliance against Italy. It would be tragic. I don't remember now whether it was Chevalier or Bob Oppenheimer or any other member who expressed himself along these lines, but this was the tone of the meeting. Nelson reinforced Chevalier's ambiguous description of Oppenheimer's party membership. I don't know that I could prove or disprove the point, Nelson said, so I'll just leave it at that. That he was a close sympathizer. I know that to be a fact because we had a number of discussions of policies of the left. Now, that doesn't mean that he was a member of the party. I think he was a close friend of a number of party members on campus. Nelson himself left the Communist Party in 1957. In 1981, he published a memoir in which he briefly discussed his relationship to Oppenheimer. When he showed the manuscript to one of his old California comrades, still a party member, this old communist thought he had been too easy on Oppenheimer. Nelson should have attacked Oppenheimer for having denied his affiliation with the party. "My own estimate of Oppenheimer," Nelson remarked, "was that he had this association with the left. Whether one had a party card or not didn't matter. He was associated with the causes of the left, and that was enough to murder him politically." All the members of this allegedly closed party unit are dead, but one of them left behind an unpublished memoir. Gordon Griffiths, 1915 to 2001, joined the Communist Party in Berkeley in June 1936, just before leaving for Oxford. Upon his return in the summer of 1939, Griffiths quietly renewed his party membership. But because his wife, Mary, had become disillusioned with the party, Griffiths asked for a low-profile assignment. Eventually, he was given the job of liaison with the faculty group at the University of California. Griffiths took the assignment in the autumn of 1940 and left it in the spring of 1942. In his memoir, he writes that out of the several hundred faculty members in Berkeley, only three were members of this faculty communist group. Arthur Brodier, an authority on Icelandic sagas and Beowulf in the English department, Håkon Chevalier, and Robert Oppenheimer. Griffiths acknowledges Oppenheimer's denial of ever having been a party member. Oppenheimer's defenders, Griffiths points out, have always explained Oppenheimer's fellow traveling with the assertion that he was politically naive. A great deal of energy was spent by well-intentioned liberals who felt that this was the only way to defend his case. Perhaps at the time, at the height of the McCarthyite period, it was. But the time has come to set the record straight and to put the question as it should have been put, not whether or not he had or had not been a member of the Communist Party, but whether such membership should, in itself, constitute an impediment to his service in a position of trust. Griffiths' memoir adds few details to Chevalier's description of what he called the closed unit. Understandably, Griffiths clearly believes that the mere fact of Oppenheimer's attendance in these meetings qualified him as a communist. He writes that the group met regularly, twice a month, either at Chevalier's house or at Oppenheimer's house. Griffiths usually brought along recent party literature to distribute, and he collected dues from Brodier and Chevalier, but not from Oppenheimer. "I was given to understand that Oppenheimer, as a man of independent wealth, made his contribution through some special channel. Nobody carried a party card. If payment of dues was the only test of membership, I could not testify that Oppenheimer was a member, but I can say, without any qualification, that all three men considered themselves to be communists." The faculty group, Griffiths recalls, didn't actually do very much. That could not have been done as a group of liberals or Democrats. They encouraged each other to devote their energies to such good causes as the teachers' union and the plight of refugees from the Spanish Civil War. "There was never any discussion of the exciting developments in theoretical physics, classified or otherwise, let alone any suggestion of passing information to the Russians. In short, there was nothing subversive or treasonable about our activity. The meetings were devoted mainly to the discussion of events on the world and national scene and to their interpretation. In these discussions, Oppenheimer was always the one who gave the fullest and most profound explanations in the light of his understanding of Marxist theory. To describe his attachment to left-wing causes as the result of political naivete, as many have done, is absurd and diminishes the intellectual stature of a man who saw the implications of what was happening in the political world more deeply than most." Kenneth O. May, the Berkeley CP functionary who assigned Griffiths to this group, later told the FBI that Håkon Chevalier and other Berkeley professors attended its meetings, but that he did not consider the group who participated in these gatherings to consist of a CP group. Once a graduate student in Berkeley's math department, Ken May was a friend of Oppenheimer's. May joined the Communist Party in 1936, and he visited Russia for 5 weeks in 1937 and again in 1939 for 2 weeks. He returned enamored of the Soviet political and economic model. During local elections in Berkeley in 1940, May gave a speech before the school board defending the right of local Communist Party candidates to hold a meeting on the grounds of a public school. When the speech drew coverage in the local press, his father, a conservative UC Berkeley political scientist,
publicly disinherited him, and the university canceled his teaching assistantship. The next year, May campaigned as a communist for a seat on the Berkeley City Council while still a graduate student in the math department. His affiliation with the Communist Party was thus no secret when he first met Oppenheimer. May was a friend of Gene Tatlock's, and the two men were probably introduced at a meeting of the teachers' union sometime in 1939. Years later, after he had left the party, May told the FBI he had visited Oppenheimer's home on several occasions to talk politics and recalled seeing him at informal gatherings, which were held for the purpose of discussing theoretical questions concerning socialism. He added that he did not consider Oppenheimer to be either a party member or someone under CP discipline. Oppenheimer was an independent intellectual and, May explained to the FBI, the CP tended to distrust intellectuals as a group in the management of CP affairs. But at the same time, the party was anxious to influence the thinking of such people along CP lines and to gain the prestige and support of communist objectives which they would lend to the party. For this reason, May would keep in touch with the subject, Oppenheimer, and other professional people. He would discuss communism with them and would provide them with CP literature. Oppenheimer, May explained to the FBI agents, was the kind of man who was quite willing to agree with CP aims and objectives at any particular time if he had decided in his own mind that they had merit. He would not, however, condone those objectives with which he did not agree. May observed that the subject openly associated with whomever he pleased, communists or not. The FBI would never resolve the question of whether or not Robert was a CP member, which is to say that there was scant evidence that he was. Much of the evidence in the FBI files on this issue is circumstantial and contradictory. If a few of the FBI's informants claimed that Oppenheimer was a communist, most of its informants merely painted a portrait of a fellow traveler, and some emphatically denied that he was ever a party member. The Bureau had only its suspicions and the conjectures of others. Only Oppenheimer himself knew, and he always insisted that he had never been a member of the Communist Party.